From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This is where politics meets economics. The president wants lawmakers to pass the financial bailout bill hammered out over the weekend, but that's not happening. With more, we've got NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving with an explainer. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So what's going on Capitol Hill?
The bill did not pass. This was something that people did not even want to contemplate over the last several days as the negotiations went on day and night. They wanted to assume that if they could get the leadership of both parties in both the House and Senate to say that this was going to pass and that their vote counts would tell them that this would be enough to pass, that in fact they could call it a deal and assume that the floor would vote for the bill, the product of all these negotiations. What we have learned here is that the ducks were not in a row. There were not enough Republicans willing to vote for the bill, and the Democrats were not willing to pass the bill strictly on Democratic votes.
Where did the Republicans and Democrats divide?
I don't think there's really a great deal of disagreement about what is good and bad about this bill. I think this is all politics. I think what you have here is an example of the minority party saying, we're not going to vote for this because we know it's not going to be popular. Yes, we know it's coming from the President of the United States, and yes, the President is a Republican and we're the Republican minority, but they are deathly afraid that this bill is going to be terribly unpopular and hung around their necks. Also, a lot of the Republicans and some of the Democrats have philosophical and ideological objections to the bill, but that's not really what's driving this vote at this point. This is a bill that contains a lot of things in it that are going to be unpopular with the general public. People are going to ask, why do we have to bail out financial institutions? Why are we buying mortgage-backed securities instead of just going in and guaranteeing individual mortgages? And as a result, it's much easier politically to let somebody else pass the bailout, save the financial industry, and then run against the unpopular elements of the bailout.
So if no one wants to be left holding the bag, what happens now?
The president is going to have to go back to the drawing board with his Treasury Secretary and say, what can we propose that will bring more members of our own party on board in the House? Now, in the Senate, people were apparently willing to take more of a long view. Although we have not had a vote in the Senate, it was anticipated that there would be roughly half of the Republicans in the Senate who would be willing to vote for it. So this is really a problem primarily located in the House, where people all have to be on the ballot just 5 weeks from tomorrow. And those people just don't want to be seen voting to bail out Wall Street. They see it as poison back home.
This became a huge issue in the presidential race last week. How do you think that's going to play out this week?
Both of the candidates were playing it cagey over the weekend. They were saying they didn't see any reason that they would vote against the bill, or they sort of expected they would be for the bill, but they weren't coming right out and saying they loved the bill. No one loves the bill. No one wants to be on the side of bailing out Wall Street. Anything that can be described as bailing out Wall Street is political poison. So it's entirely possible that neither of the two candidates was even really planning to come back on Wednesday and vote on this, moot point at the moment. But neither one of them wants to be associated with it. And in their first debate last Friday night, both of them did everything they could to hold it at arm's length.
So, Ron, do you think there's any chance that this will be brought back in short order?
Can't rule it out. They only need about a dozen more votes. Theoretically, you should be able to turn around a dozen votes for something this important, but it's not easy, and there are an awful lot of people now who feel as though they've been betrayed by one side or the other. Getting back to the trust that was necessary just to have the vote be this close when they took it the first time this afternoon is going to be difficult.
Ron, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Farai.
That was NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving, and he joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now we've got more on how this financial crisis is affecting you. First of all, where's your money? If you hear your bank has collapsed, what does that really mean for your finances? Dr. Julianne Malveaux is here to give us some insight. She's an economist and the president of Bennett College. Hi, how you doing?
Hi, how are you, Farai?
Quite well. So if your bank technically fails, like Washington Mutual or Wachovia, does that mean that you've got a zero balance all of a sudden?
No, if you have less than $100,000, up to $100,000 in an account, it's insured by the FDIC. So while the you know, Wachovia has been taken over by Wells Fargo, while WaMu has also been taken over, your deposits are good. So people who have less than $100,000 should not be concerned. Now, if you have over $100,000, technically you may have a problem. And this is a wake-up call for everyone else who may have more than $100,000 in one account. It's now time to think about diversifying your accounts because the FDIC covers deposits up to $100,000.
So with these bigger banks, people who have their ATMs can walk up and still withdraw money just like they did before. But what if you are part of a smaller bank or a credit union? Even if the money is guaranteed, could you hit a snag if the bank has problems? And is it possible for a bank to say to you or a credit union to say to you, we're going to give you your money, but just not right now?
We're way down the line on that, Farai. That's not likely to happen any time in the next month or so. So people should not panic. People really should not panic. Certainly, that it's within the realm of possibility that such a thing would happen, but it's not going to happen right away. First of all, Congress is so attuned to the consumer in this, and any notion that there would be a run on a bank would be immediately addressed by Congress. But secondly, that's just not where we are. Frankly, my position is that while I think that this is an important moment, I think that Mr. Paulson, our Treasury Secretary, has way overplayed his hand, which is why, as Ron was reporting, there's some reluctance. This is not the kind of emergency that's an emergency. It's not a tomorrow thing. And so because I think that there's a lot of politics involved here, a lot of other things involved, and inquiring minds, and that's what our Congress is supposed to be, are raising all kinds of questions. But we're not going to have a situation in the next 30 days where banks are going to say, we can't pay you.
All right. This plan does not...
Now, stock is another story. Let me say something else. Stock is another story.
Okay.
If you have stock in a bank, if you have WaMu stock, if you have Wachovia stock, be careful. Look at that. Look at what's going on there. This is not the time necessarily to bail out, but people who have stock in Merrill Lynch are, you know, lost about 70% of their value.
Well, what about homeowners? Because there was some talk of finding ways to help homeowners directly who were in trouble. What happened to that?
There will be. We've got to keep our eyes on what's going on and what kind of negotiations are taking place. There should be something for homeowners. If you're going to help banks, you have to help homeowners. And I think that Barney Frank, Congressman Frank from Massachusetts, has done a really great job of injecting some populism into something that could have simply been a bailout for banks. We're not going to see the results of that. Again, you know, 60 to 90 days is the timeline on this.
Yeah, and Barney Frank is head of the House Finance Committee or Financial Services Committee. Anyway, let's turn to a Republican, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, talking on This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
You have the former chairman of Goldman Sachs asking for $700 billion. And in his initial request, asking for it in such an un-American way.
No review.
That I think he should have resigned. I think Paulson has terminally misunderstood the nature of the American system. Not just no review, no judicial review, no congressional accountability. Give me $700 billion. $700 billion. I'll be glad to spend it for you. That's a centralization of power that is totally un-American.
All right. So you mentioned Secretary Paulson before. Explain what kind of power he has and what do you think about Newt Gingrich's statements, obviously very passionate statements about this?
You know, Farai, I never thought in my lifetime that Newt Gingrich and I would ever be on the same page. But in this case, we are. I mean, I think that Mr. Paulson has been irresponsible. I think that his initial proposal was way out of line, and that's why we do have a process that allows the Congress and others to weigh in. The Democrats, Congresswoman Pelosi, the Majority Leader, Congressman Frank, have really been exceptional in this process because what Paulson asked, he asked for $700 billion. Just give me $700 billion, excuse me? You know, give me 1% of that for my college, and I'd be over the moon. But he just asked for it without any kinds of strings. His initial proposal was really not good. What the Congress has done is slowed him down and said that, you know, monies will be essentially dispersed, but on a timeline and with congressional approval and with more details about who they're going to go to and why. So what we have here is clearly a situation where the confidence in the entirety of our monetary system is about confidence. If people don't believe it works, then it's not going to work. So we're shoring up confidence by saying that the Feds will be the guarantor of last resort. What has the Democrats have done is said, but the Feds will be paid back first. So this is not a gift, it's a loan. And that's really important for the American people who have not had any gifts. But Gingrich is right here. Paulson has been irresponsible and probably should step down. But then again, my position is that there are a whole lot of people who might step down. They might start at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
All right. Very quickly, when you think of homeowners, what should they be looking for next from the political system, this political debate?
Homeowners should be looking at interest rates. They should be looking at the context of interest rates to see what's going on. Right now, money is very tight. It's going to loosen up. If you're in negotiations right now, you might want to slow those down. If you're trying to buy a home in the next 30, 60 days, you might want to slow down and just make sure that you get a good interest rate. People who are about to be in foreclosure should be aggressive about dealing with their banks and waiting to see what kind of opportunities they'll have, because opportunities will arise. Do not do anything in the next 30 to 60 days. If someone pushes you, you know, find an attorney, find help. There are people out there, Acorn and others, who will help you get through this. People should really be aggressive about taking care of their needs.
All right. Dr. Malveaux, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Julianne Malveaux is an author, economist, and president of Bennett College. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's presidential debate season, and the folks on our Bloggers Roundtable are ready to slice and dice the winners and the losers and give us their 2 cents on how the Veep debate this week could play out. With us, we've got Charles Robinson. He blogs at Charles Black Politics Blog, Issa Yulin, who blogs at IssaYulin.com, and Anthony Bradley, creator of the blog The Institute. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hey.
So NPR's Ron Elving and Dr. Julianne Malveaux just gave us their take on the big economic bill. Both presidential candidates say they support it. Issa, do you think it's a good idea for the presidential candidates to endorse it when, frankly, it's not quite solid yet? The jelly is still setting.
I think it's important for both candidates to weigh in, and that's why I was so shocked with McCain's shenanigans when he claimed he didn't want to go to the debate down at Ole Miss. Even though this is a work in progress and things are still being ironed out, I think it's important that we know where each candidate stands, particularly because this is something that for at least the next couple of years, whomever's going to be our next president has to continue to deal with this crisis.
It sounds like you think that when Senator McCain said that he might not come to the debates, it wasn't helping. It was hurting.
It was hurting the American people. I think it was hurting his campaign, and it was just kind of bizarre.
Charles, what do you think about that move?
Fryer, this was a buy-in. This wasn't a kind of a sellout. But as much as understand this, we're in a very precarious situation. People are talking about a depression, not even a recession anymore. And I think each of these candidates, they couldn't say they didn't want to go with it, because essentially they would be saying, all right, I want to send the world into a depression. And this was supposedly the signal. The bigger issue, I think, is what people are saying out in the field. Understand, I just listened to some of the debate coming from the Congress, and I'm going to tell you, this is the toughest vote that they will ever make. Think about it, $700 billion. I can't even imagine what that looks like in one room.
That depends on how big the bills are, I guess. Anthony, do you think that, you know, at this point, when you think about the debate that already happened, I want to transition to that. Do you think that there was a clear definition of economic policy by the two major party presidential candidates?
Well, there was definitely a clear difference. It was interesting if you watched the debate. It was very clear that both candidates have a very different view of the role of government as with respect to managing the economy. And we see with this bailout program that both candidates, as they weigh in, are weighing in cautiously because each candidate's particular base has different perspectives on this issue.
Charles, how do you think that they fared? I mean, you know, a lot of people have been giving their thumbs up and thumbs down. How do you think that the two gentlemen fared?
Well, I want to talk about how I heard this debate. First of all, I listened to it on radio, which was, I think, a lot different than television. In fact, I think McCain won the debate on radio, but I thought Barack won the debate on television. The visual was the key for television viewers. For radio viewers, listeners, if you will, I think it was the simplistic tone of John McCain. And just a plug for NPR, I listened to it on NPR. And it was quite clear to me as I was listening to it that Barack continued to sound professorial, if you will, and trying to give these elongated. John McCain was very simple. I take that situation where Lara asked the question about, well, what would you cut? John McCain cut right to the case. I'm going to cut programs right across the board. Well, you know what? I thought that resonated, whereas the convoluted, I don't know what I'm going to cut, I might cut, I don't know what I'm going to do, was very indecisive. But getting back to the television portion, understand, a challenger who comes to a debate like this, and I think Barack was still the underdog, he stands up with stature and he's able to send the message to those undecided voters. Remember, this is not for the people in the room. It's totally for the undecideds and the people who are outside the room.
Issa, first of all, how did you get the debate? And secondly, you know, some people are saying, well, Obama is considered to have won simply because he didn't lose. There was a low expectation for him because he's not known always as a great debater. How did that play out for you?
Well, I watched it on television with my husband. We were actually invited to a debate party. People have been having those here in New York. But we decided to stay at home that night and watch it together. And I have to say that I think that for those people who are going to support McCain, they're going to feel even more strongly about McCain. And for those Barack supporters, they feel strongly about their candidate. I agree that the toss-ups, the people who are really going to decide this election are the undecideds and independent voters in particular. And I think that for most of them, as you said, because Obama wasn't, if they're unsure about Obama, they're unsure about him being presidential. They're unsure about him making the kinds of decisions that are going to be crucial in the next 4 to 8 years. And I think that because he had those low expectations, he came in at least a draw, then that kind of bumps him up to the winner.
All right. Well, for folks just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This is our bloggers roundtable, and you were just hearing from Issa Yulin, who blogs at issayulin.com. We've also got Charles Robinson, who blogs at Charles Black Politics blog, and Anthony Bradley of the Institute blog. Okay, so we've talked about the last debate, the presidential debate, and then there is a vice presidential debate coming up. It's going to be the only one of the season. Both Governor Palin and Senator Joe Biden have had their moments. Let's listen to a quick clip of Joe Biden talking with CBS News's Katie Couric.
Part of what a leader does is to instill confidence, is demonstrate that he or she knows what they're talking about and communicates to people, if you listen to me and follow what I'm suggesting, we can fix this. When the stock market crashed, Franklin Roosevelt got on television and didn't just talk about the princes of greed. He said, look, here's what happened.
All right, Anthony, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, there's some historical inaccuracies there where Biden obviously put his foot in his mouth because if one actually looks at the historical record, FDR actually wasn't president, and he came in office after the fact to fix Hoover's mess, and that television was in the experimental phase and hadn't been developed yet, and that radio was actually the main medium of communication. So if someone's going to actually listen to Biden, who says you have to know what he's talking about, and then he actually makes a major historical blunder like that, it calls into question some of his own principles.
You know, he's known more for gaffes that have to do with personality, and there was that embarrassing moment where he asked a man in a wheelchair to stand. But this is a different kind. I mean, do you think we're going to get to Sarah Palin in a moment? But Charles, are you surprised that Senator Biden had this kind of historical inaccuracy?
You know, on the stump, you're liable to say anything. I always find it very unusual because, you know, you want to rile up the crowd. You're sitting there and you see all these folks. You want to kind of feed them some red meat. You know what? Hey, I give it to you if you miss a few here and there. But, you know, these are kind of big. The problem is that your opponent will use them against you. And I anticipate that, you know, this is going to be, you know, the Obama-McCain debate was collegial. I don't expect any collegiality in this next debate.
Okay, well, actually, Governor Palin got her turn with Katie Couric last week. Let's listen to a little bit of her.
It is from Alaska that we send those out to make sure that an eye is being kept on this very powerful nation, Russia, because they are right there.
Okay. Issa, a lot of people have mocked her. And in fact, Katie Couric used the word mocked, to describe the way that Sarah Palin has been viewed lately. And we just heard Charles saying, okay, this is going to be gloves off. If this is a situation where Sarah Palin is being mocked for her foreign policy experience or lack thereof, what kind of gloves are going to be taken off? What do you expect from this debate?
I expect a lot of humor. I think that with
humor?
The...
Really?
Yeah, I expect to be laughing out loud on Thursday as I watch this debate between the firecracker and the pit. It's going to be the pit bull against the bulldog, and we'll see which dog wins. Biden is sharp. Yeah, he blundered on the FDR thing. I think he was thinking about fireside chats and radio. But Sarah Palin, I mean, she just doesn't have the factual information that's required of someone in an executive position. And it's not just her inability to clearly articulate what she understands. It's her lack of understanding. And, I look forward to Thursday, but I really look forward to Saturday Night Live.
wait, hold that thought, because we have a clip of Tina Fey, one of the most successful women in show business right now, and certainly in comedy, impersonating Governor Palin on this weekend, Saturday Night Live.
Every morning when Alaskans wake up, one of the first things they do is look outside to see if there are any Russians hanging around. If there are, you gotta go up to them and ask, what are you doing here? And if they can give you a good reason, they can, then you start responsibility to say, you know, shoo, get back over there.
Anthony, what do you think of this whole, I mean, because there are a lot of people who've been out with comedy. Chris Rock is coming out with some political comedy, but Tina Fey has been on a roll.
Tina Fey
absolutely,
has nailed this role.
Palin sadly has given too much material for comedians to play with. One of the things that the Republicans are going to have to do is have Palin appear knowledgeable and competent. And I hope that they are infusing her with some information capital as we approach Thursday, or else this thing is going to be one of the most comical vice presidential elections that we've seen in quite some time.
Look, I want if you don't mind,
go ahead, sure.
I want everybody to be to think what the Republicans have done in the past. Diminished expectations. What they really want to do is to lower what her level is. The problem is they've been feeding her stuff for the last couple of weeks. The one time she talked to some folks who was in New York at near Ground Zero, and I think this quote-unquote authenticity issue, in other words, she's kind of off the cuff. They're going to give her some one-liners to use back and forth. The problem that I see is that she may use this parody of her to her advantage. In other words, no one believes that I'm going to be good. No one thinks that. Well, let me tell you who I am, kind of thing.
Well, but Charles, there's an Associated Press investigation that just came out. It found, although Governor Palin said she didn't take gifts or handouts, she did take some gifts, even wrote some thank you notes, and more importantly, got the town to sign off on a special zoning exception so she could sell her home. Do you think an investigation like this, investigative reporting, I mean, is going to come out in the debate?
Remember, they have attacked the media the entire time. In other words, no one likes me, so, you know, I'm going to just do what I'm going to do. Think about this. She's got this investigation that you just talked about, and she still has the one that's hanging over from the firing of one of her secretaries. And I think what they've come to the simple realization, it's good to run against the media because nobody likes us and nobody wants to hear from us. And if they can get their message through, in other words, these folks don't know what it's like to be from a small town. And I know everybody hates that, but you know what? It resonates.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to move on to another aspect of the race, which is the race and race. We talked about a lot of different ways that race has come into play, and now you have a life-size effigy of Senator Obama hanging from a tree on the campus of George Fox University in Oregon. It was founded by Quaker pioneers. And Anthony, you've been blogging about this. Do you think that this is clearly an attack, first of all? And is it important that this was a school founded on nonviolent and Christian principles?
That's the great irony of the situation. It was clearly a protest against Act 6, this attempt to bring minority and low-income students on the campus, that is, students that are historically unrepresented. I mean, we're talking about a school that has less than 1% African-American presence on the campus, 2% Native American, around 5% Asian, 4% Latino. And the school is desperate to get students on, and there's always backlash among established whites, often when set-aside programs are developed to encourage greater minority presence.
And we should make clear that there was a cardboard cutout message saying specifically that, you know, opposing the minority scholarships.
Absolutely. And so what's really troubling, however, is the ongoing persistent tactic of protesting against these sorts of things by whites, where the default mode of protest is to lynch a black man on a tree. We see ropes hanging from professors' offices all over the country. We saw this with the Jenna 6 case down in Louisiana. There's something troubling about the fact that even in so-called Christian community, there is this default mode where youngsters have learned that you protest against blacks by hanging a rope around a black man's neck. And my sense is that they've learned those things from the elders, because in Christian circles, it remains one of the last bastions of America where you can be a racist and a Christian. And sadly, that won't get challenged too much.
Oh, well, that's going to be a nice controversial one for letters. Issa, you also teach. What do you think of the environment on campuses these days? I mean, is there increasing tolerance or still problems?
Well, I teach at Hunter College in New York City, so it would be difficult for an intolerant student to negotiate that space. The student population really represents the world. I think that, you know, there is this level of violence abroad with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which comes home to our communities when the service personnel return, but also in the language and support of the war. Although there is a backlash against it right now, that sort of violent language is still very much in place. In addition to what happened in Gina, Louisiana, just recently the sixth white defendant admitted his role in the torture of Megan Williams in Charleston, West Virginia. So I think black women are also being attacked, physically assaulted, lynched, if you will. And it's troubling. You know, an interesting aspect of being black in America is that you have to deal simultaneously, sort of psychologically handle the victory and thrill of accomplishment and weigh that against the inevitable backlash that is a very often expressed in physical violence, symbolic or actual. Whether you look at our success in World War II and then the lynchings that followed of, you know, black veterans in uniform, you know, we have this wonderful triumph with Barack Obama and his ascendancy, and yet this backlash just affects all of us on such a deep and visceral level.
Issa,
No,
we're just going to have to wrap up, and it's interesting you mention black veterans, because we're going to talk about that in a second. But guys, I want to thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We were talking to Issa Yulin, who blogs at issayulin.com. She was at NPR's New York studios. Charles Robinson, who blogs at Charles Black Politics Blog and joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Anthony Bradley, creator of the Institute blog, he joined us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Illinois Senator Barack Obama declared he was running for president back in February of 2007. Back then, he was the dark horse, long shot candidate. Some people looked at him and talked only about race. Other voters and pundits seemed to try to avoid the topic. Now the economy's in meltdown, and much of the political debate has turned to mortgages and finance. But race is still there, say the polls, and author and commentator Tim Wise says so as well. Wise is an anti-racism activist whose latest book is called Speaking Treason Fluently, Anti-Racist Reflections from an Angry White Male. Welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks.
So your latest essay is called This Is Your Nation on White Privilege.
Right.
What does that really mean?
Well, you know, what I was trying to do was to flip the discussion on race a little bit. A lot of times we only look for race in a situation when it's obvious and blatant and bigoted. And what I was trying to point out was that the flip side of racism and discrimination, which is white privilege, the advantage that those of us who are white often have, has played out dramatically in this race, where you have candidates like John McCain and Sarah Palin, whose personal narratives, stories, things that they've done and said, they are cut far more slack on than would be the case were their narratives Obama's narrative. And so I point out a few examples. You know, I think that if one of Obama's daughters was 17 and was pregnant, and the individual who'd gotten her pregnant was someone who described himself in the kind of terms that Levi Johnston did on his MySpace page, for example, where he used all kinds of pretty foul language to describe himself, said that if you messed with him, he'd, you know, kick your you-know-what, that person, if they were black, would be seen as a thug. But in the case of someone like Levi Johnston, they can just be seen as a good stand-up guy, all-American boy, bring him to the Republican convention, John McCain shakes his hand. I mean, I think the standard would be quite a bit different. I think we know that.
On one of the blogs that has, really gone crazy with your article, and by gone crazy, I mean with huge amounts of responses.
Right.
One of the people, Frederick Christie, writes, a lot of this is partisanship, Tim. And he goes on from there to really basically say, you know, this is on Red Room. He goes from there to basically say, you know, this is not about white privilege. This is about, you know, basically what Republicans do and Democrats do and what happens in political races. Why do you think that's not the case if you don't?
Well, actually, I know Frederick, and if you read through those whole, I mean, there's 200-some-odd responses, he ends up actually coming to my defense and defending the argument, so he actually sort of somewhat takes back his position. I think he's right in some ways. Look, some of the stuff is just pure partisanship. The point I'm simply trying to make is, yes, obviously each party is going to play its own partisan games, and one is going to say Obama's not qualified because he doesn't have executive experience, and Obama's side is going to say Palin isn't qualified because she has no foreign policy experience. And of course, that's partisan. But my point is, you know, let's take the executive experience situation. If Obama, let's say that Barack Obama had been the mayor of a small town in the Mississippi Delta, or let's say that he had been the mayor of a small town in rural Illinois, similar in size to Wasilla, and then maybe instead of going to the U.S. Senate, he'd been elected governor of Illinois and he'd served in that position for 18 months. I doubt very seriously that the individuals who now claim that Sarah Palin is qualified would be so quick to say that he was. They would switch the goalposts from talking about executive experience to, oh, well, he doesn't have foreign policy experience. Part of that's partisanship, but part of it is that white privilege allows white folks, and I'm white, so I mean I know a little bit about the way we as white folks are viewed in this country. White folks have the luxury and the privilege of being mediocre. We can be mediocre. It's the same thing I hear everywhere I go when I speak at colleges, and I'm constantly told that the departments who are hiring in a school always say we're looking for a black person, but we want to get the best black person, or we want to get the best Latino. I've never heard anyone say, now we want to make sure we get the best white applicant. It's as if they're saying if it's a person of color, they've got to absolutely be the cream of the crop, and even then we may not view them as that good. If they're a white person, they can be pretty mediocre, like a C student, George W. Bush, and that's okay. But if you're, you know, the editor of the Harvard Law Review and at the top of your class, oh, we don't know about you. You know, to me, well, that's about white privilege. Yeah.
So what's changed in how people perceive your message?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of white folks, and unfortunately, this doesn't get talked about a whole lot, but I think that there are a lot of white folks, particularly young white folks, who are starting to come into a recognition of just how important race is in this country, in spite of all the rhetoric, in spite of all that we hear about how we've transcended race. I know I've been hearing from folks who work in the Obama campaign, they're volunteers on the campaign, some of them even paid staff, who were shocked at the vitriol that they have encountered on the campaign trail, who really, I think, bought into the transcendent race in a post-racial America type sense that was sort of the underlying rhetoric of the campaign they joined, and who were stunned to see the level of racism that is still quite prevalent. I think it's been a huge wake-up call. And on the one hand, I think that's an extremely good thing for the country. If we can get white folks to begin to see what people of color have known for a very long time, then that means that no matter what happens in November, whether Obama wins or loses, that those individuals who've been involved in the campaign, who have been inspired by his message, will realize that they have got work to do, and that work is not going to end on November 5th.
What do you see unfolding as a result of this election, whether or not Senator Obama wins or Senator McCain wins? Do you think it's going to advance how people think about race and how people deal with it in their own lives?
I think it's very much an open question. I think the risk is, of course, that if Obama wins, a lot of white folks will want to declare that racism is obviously dead. And that, I think, would be ridiculously premature. The evidence of institutional and systemic discrimination against millions of people of color is still very obvious in spite of the success of this one man of color, just as we know that Benazir Bhutto becoming prime minister of Pakistan not once but twice didn't mean sexism wasn't a problem in Pakistan. Same thing here with racism and Obama. We in the culture have got to understand if we want his success up to now to mean anything beyond him, if we want it to mean something in terms of turning the corner and addressing the issues of racism and white privilege and inequality in this country, that's going to be up to us. That's going to require us to get out there and challenge systemic and institutional discrimination in housing, in the job market, in the criminal justice system, and not put all of our eggs in the basket of electoral politics.
Well, Tim, great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
That was anti-racism activist Tim Wise. He's the author of several books, including a new collection of essays entitled Speaking Treason Fluently, Anti-Racist Reflections from an Angry White Male. You can read his latest essay on white privilege by going to nprnewsandviews.org. Filmmaker Spike Lee's latest movie, Miracle at St. Anna, opened over the weekend. It took in a modest $3.5 million. It's a story about four members of the all-black 92nd Buffalo Soldier Division. They're fighting the Nazis, and they get trapped behind enemy lines in Italy during World War II.
You, come here.
Gather the rest of whoever will come, and we'll take them down the mountain.
Would you not come with you?
Why not?
Nazis in all villages.
Yeah. Boom, boom. You just sit tight and it'll be jingle bells real soon. The U.S. Army is sitting right here in front of you.
We need army inside house now. 3 years we've been waiting. First the British, then the Americans. Italy is tired to wait.
On Friday, we featured some of the stars of the film plus its writer. Now we have NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates, who got the chance to sit down with Spike Lee. This has been a project of the heart for him. His mission started with the men of the 92nd Buffalo Soldier Division.
15,000 African-American men stationed in Italy. They fought in the army that was segregated. Many of their commanding officers were from the South. That was a policy. The army, they felt that somehow that white Southerners could control Negroes better than the white officers from the North. That was a recipe for disaster. That did not work out at all.
At one point in the film, one of the generals says,
General Allman, real person,
says, "This is Mrs. Roosevelt's little experiment, and we're going to have to live with it," which
right.
indicated to me that there was a fair amount of resentment at having to even deal with the idea of black combatants.
Yes, it's a known fact that it was the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, getting on her husband's case day after day, FDR. So he finally, probably to get some peace of mind, said, okay, I'll let them fight. Because they weren't allowed to fight at first. It was just, you could cook, you could clean, you could do the menial stuff, but they did not feel they had really the guts to fight, that when the bullets started flying, that the black soldiers would just drop and run.
Were they also worried about black soldiers with guns?
Well, that was the case really in the States. Many towns had objections to these black bases with these men armed.
Yet you have these men who get separated from their general unit in the hills of Tuscany.
Right. Behind Nazi lines.
Behind enemy lines. They show up in, I mean, as I was looking at the film, I kept saying, you know, in some ways, this is the Italian equivalent of Appalachia. You know, they're living up in these tiny, isolated little hamlets where everybody knows everybody else, or they're related to everybody else in some kind of tangential way. They've got, you know, feuds and connections that go back several generations. And they've mostly seen their own people all this time.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, here come these brothers.
They've never seen a black person before, ever. But they saw these men as their liberators. They've been waiting for the United States Army. First, they were waiting for the British, and the Americans came. So this is true. While we were shooting Tuscany, several times elderly Italians told me about their fond memories as children seeing the Buffalo Soldiers, the black soldiers.
What did they remember about them?
Well, one lady told me that she's alive today because of Buffalo Soldiers. She had just been born a month or two old. She was dying of some illness. Her mother took her to the black camp. The black doctors gave her shots, probably penicillin, and she lived. And she told me the story, tears running down her eyes, and she just grabbed me and hugged me. She said, I'm alive because of the Buffalo Soldiers.
So they had more than one job while they were there. And yeah. It seems that they were acutely conscious of that, that they weren't just soldiers, that they had this larger responsibility that white soldiers, to a certain degree, didn't have.
And also many of them felt, as one of Derek Luke's characters says in the film, that for the first time they felt free. And they, in reflection, saying that it's a shame for the first time to feel free in a foreign country and not in their own home, their native land.
At one point, they were having an argument about whether they should stay, whether they should go, whether this was, you know, going to lead to certain disaster. And Staff Sergeant Aubrey Stamps says, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for my kids, for my kids' kids. Mm-hmm. This is our country, too.
Progress.
This is progress. This is progress. We have to make progress. What did he mean by that?
Well, it's something that all African Americans have felt. I think it was felt when Crispus Attucks was killed by the British in the Boston Massacre. He was the first person to die in the war for the United States of America, a black man. We felt that in the Civil War, World War I, World War II, even today in Iraq and Afghanistan. I find it amusing when people question the patriotism of African Americans. It's so easy to be a patriot when you're receiving the full rights and benefits of a citizen. It's much more to be a patriot when you're being lynched, to live in the apartheid or Jim Crow segregation, denied your rights as a human being. And despite that, again and again and again, African Americans have taken up the mantle and fought and died for this country. And as you said before, Stamps talk about promise. Well, we're about to see that promise finally. November 4th, this country's going to vote for the 44th President of the United States of America. The promise that Stamps talked about, I think we're getting to that point because this thing is going to happen. And that is, for me, concrete evidence that this country has made a seismic move as far as race relations go that we've yet to see, that a black man, someone whose father was born in Kenya, is going to be the commander-in-chief.
He certainly will be if he's elected.
He's going to win.
Okay. If he wins, does
I'm
fact...
Whoa. You could say if.
Well, I have to. I'm a reporter.
Okay, but I'm not a reporter, and I can't let people ask me, so what happens if he... I don't think like that. The man, we're going to be delivered on November 4th. That's okay. Me. I'm speaking for myself.
Let's look at it from your perspective then. He gets elected on November 4th. Is part of why he gets elected this service that the real-life Aubrey Stamps have done, this down payment that they've made in order to get to this point.
It's not just him. We could go on. Harry Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Shirley Chisholm, W.D. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, Malcolm, Dr. King, JFK. You know, so everything that's happened, you know, he's on their shoulders, I feel.
This is... in a way, this film, a big public thank you to people who didn't get thanked enough.
We filmed the supplement for the DVD recently of Miracle St. Anna. We had a round table with several Buffalo soldiers. These men now in their later ages, very graceful, dignified men. And one gentleman, I can't recall his name, he said, I put my life in the line for this country. And I was hoping and praying that this would hopefully prove to white America that we are worthy and we belong and we're Americans. The war is over. His ship left from England and it docked, I think, Newport News or Hampton, you know, wherever the naval base there. And it pulled up to the thing. And before they could set their feet on American soil, walking down a plank, at the end of the plank, you had a sign, colored troops to the left, white troops to the right. And he said he almost broke down and cried right there. So these men, they're right, they should be given their due. These American heroes, the American patriots. And if this film could be in a small way to illuminate these great Americans, and then we're happy for that.
Well, this is certainly a compliment to all the rest of it. This definitely fills in some of the missing gaps. You know, when little kids my age, you know, used to come home and go, well, where are all the black soldiers in the war? Because we didn't see them in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that they will see. And wish you good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
That was filmmaker and director Spike Lee talking about his new film, Miracle at St. Anna, with NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates. You can watch his full interview plus our conversation with the cast of the film at our website, nprnewsandviews.org.